Welcome to It's a Thing, the podcast where we talk about fan studies and how it's a thing. I'm your host, Lori Morimoto. This episode of It's a Thing was recorded in October 2020 as part of the Fan Studies Network North America Conference. It features Dr. Rebecca Wanzo, Chair and Professor of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, and Affiliate Professor of American Culture Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Rebecca's most recent book, The Content of Our Caricature, African American Comic Art and Political Belonging, was recently awarded the Catherine Singer Kovacs Book Award by the Society for Cinema and Media Studies. Rebecca spoke to us at FSNNA about her disciplinarily diverse body of work, and in particular, about her work on race in fandom and fan studies. It's a great conversation, so I hope you'll stick around. Dr. Rebecca Wanzo is professor and chair of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies and affiliate professor of American Culture Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Rebecca is the author of The Paradigm Shifting Fan Studies Essay, African American Acafandom and Other Strangers, New Genealogies of Fan Studies, as well as the 2009 book, The Suffering Will Not Be Televised, African American Women and Sentimental Political Storytelling, as well as her newest book out this year entitled The Content of Our Caricature, African American Comic Art and Political Belonging. And she will be returning, I have it on good authority, to Fan Studies with a new book that will be in progress when our national nightmare is over. So Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I wanted to get started in the format that I've been doing the podcast by asking you the question that I ask everyone, which is, how did you originally come to fan studies?
So I came to fan studies through Jan Radway. When I was in graduate school, I took a class with Jan Radway. Jan was on my committee. And even earlier than that, when I was an undergrad, I read Reading the Romance, and I was drawn to it because I was a big fan of romance novels. I was a huge romance reader, and, you know, my attachments when I was younger was a lot of traditional women's culture kinds of texts. So soap operas, you know, I was the kind of person who had lots of VHS tapes, bought, you know, Soap Opera Digest, bought all the soap opera magazines, did my own versions with a friend to try to write a soap, et cetera. And then was reading when I was, you know, in junior high, and then read Jan's Reading the Romance. And so that was really important for me in my foundational shift to being a cultural studies person, even as I was an English PhD. So being a cultural studies scholar and being very influenced by the genealogy from Frankfurt School to Birmingham School, and then the set of texts in the Birmingham School that I think are really important in structurally understanding what's at stake and understanding both consumers and then people who identify themselves as fans. So things like Hebbige's subcultures, which now we would just say cultures, obviously Angela McRobbie and various other scholars, Stuart Hall, whose work is extremely important to me, even though he doesn't really think about fans per se, but really more thinks about desire and desire in relationship to identity. And so I started with Jan, and then that methodologically was really important in thinking both about industry history, how you read fans, and then how fans read themselves and understand fans as theorists, even though I think, as I would say, and she probably would even say now, her psychoanalytic reading of fans is something I wouldn't go for per se, even though that's influenced me in a variety of ways. And it's continuing through to my work now. And then, of course, when I got to textual poachers and also people like Constance Penley and NASA Trek, I started to think about how fans are theorists themselves. And that's really influenced a lot of my work as someone who, broadly speaking, studies popular culture more broadly.
I'm so thrilled to hear you talk about Janice Radway. She has not yet come up on the podcast as a foundational person, and so that's so exciting.
That's really not surprising and also horrifying. And you know, I do think it is something about, you know, the kinds of texts that people don't want to claim in relationship to fandom. And I think romance novels are very common in that. You know, one of the things we know paradigmatically and people talk about like in fan studies is that fans always produce hierarchies, like we're fans of this but not that, like always sort of, you know, I always do that when I'm sort of teaching about fandom and talk about hierarchical versions. I remember when I was teaching in grad school and talking about fandom, and I went to Duke, which is a big sports school for those of you who do not know, and you know, sports fandom is also really has a complicated place within fandom. And we were talking about MTV and girls and the ways in which people construct girlhood and fandom. And I'd asked my students, they said, well, what's, because some of them were really dismissive of them and they're crying, et cetera. And I said, well, I sit here and I watch people and young men crying when there's a win in a Duke basketball game. And there's a lot of excess and performance and, you know, things are set on fire. And so what's the difference? And we said, well, sports are real. And I went, oh, that's interesting. So, I mean, I think that those kinds of hierarchies are fairly consistent, which I think we see both in fandom, but also in fan studies itself.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm also delighted to hear about the, you know, bringing emotion to sports fans and asking the question, are you kidding me? You know, I did want to ask if you are a fan of anything yourself, past, present. And how do you or have you pursued your fandom?
Yeah, my probably first fandoms were sort of shipping, which I didn't know that's what it was. That wasn't a word that was in the 80s when I was a kid, but like in deep attachments to things like Scarecrow and Mrs. King. And later I would go and, you know, read that kind of fandom. I read, you know, I was a big fan of shows like La Femme Nikita and like fighting women shows. La Femme Nikita, Xena, Buffy. I read those, that's the stuff I read in terms of fan fiction. I didn't really try to write fan fiction months when I became an adult. I mean, I tried to do my own version of soap. So I was also a big soap fan, multiple shows, Days of Our Lives, General Hospital, which were my huge fans. And when I try to sort of communicate and show fan vids, like to try to communicate the intensity of the BJ's heart storyline in General Hospital, my students still just don't get it. But I, you know, also tried to write like my version of Sweet Valley High when I was a kid, that kind of thing. And also like a multiracial soap around the same time that Generations came out, which is so probably very few people know. So that's sort of before. And it's been harder for me. And I used to sort of like lurk on the message boards and only rarely intrude on them to sort of make some commentaries. I used to, you know, on Television Without Pity, I used to, you know, comment on those message boards sometimes. And then over time, you know, I just don't have the bandwidth or time really to engage in fandom in that way. I mean, I sort of start looking at fan fiction usually when it's rolling up to teach every year. Mm-hmm. And then I try to find something else. Now I tend to teach Supernatural because they have such great shows. And I'm sort of always curious about what kind of robust, interesting things Supernatural fans are doing. That's a show I've been in and out of over years, but I'm trying to catch up on now that it's ending. And more recently, my deep attachment. So the question is, am I really a fan, or what does it mean as an academic that I'm writing about it? But I, you know, I claim ACA fandom in a way that's not problematic for me, even though other people find the term ACA fandom problematic and uncritical, but I don't necessarily understand it that way. That I love Watchmen. I'm a huge fan of Michaela Cole. I actually think HBO is doing some really interesting things around race and fandom, and in terms of the television shows, and what does it mean to sort of understand people who are fans than doing commercial work, right? Can we see it that way? I mean, Damon Lindelof says Watchmen is basically fan fiction. I mean, I think we should sort of take things seriously, like what, you know, what that means. And then, you know, I forgave him for the ending of Lost after I saw The Leftovers, and Lost was also something I obsessively watched. I mean, basically the general thing to understand here, Lori, is that I consume many, many things. I am deeply attached to many things, The Good Place, et cetera. So I'm always in this, I'm always seeking something else to love. And then of course, the thing that runs through all time is Star Trek.
Oh, which Star Trek?
So my general answer to that is that I think the Star Trek with the highest quality is Deep Space Nine, but my favorite Star Trek is Voyager. Mm. And I will fight anyone who wants to talk about Janeway. But I think Lower Decks is actually quite good. And I loved when Discovery started. I mean, of course, Discovery to have a Black female protagonist was the dream, which then they undercut the second season by feeling they had to make it about Spock. So right. Thoughts about that.
But hopefully this next season, it looks like it's heading back to her. So I'm hoping it's a Michael show again.
This Thursday. So I'm a perpetual Star Trek fan. I'm a sci-fi person. And it's a great moment for sci-fi. The Expanse is extraordinary. I was a huge Eureka fan. I still haven't really Sci-Fi Network for taking it off. So anyway, this is what I'll say. I can see many things and we'll watch many things over and over and can talk for hours about many kinds of television shows.
Well, and see, if it was just you and me, we would be talking for many hours about lots of different television shows. Unfortunately, it's not. So I'm going to move on to Acafandom and Other Strangers, African-American Acafandom and Other Strangers. So, like, you know, I'm going to contract it here. And I'm curious, you know, it's been 5 years since that essay came out. I did put a link up on Twitter for anyone who has not read it yet. It is open access. And as you describe it, the essay looks at, and I'm going to quote you here, a rich history of Black fan criticism and ACA-fandom that has never been seen as such, but that both complements and complicates current definitions and paradigms in fan studies. And so building on that, I'd like to ask first, what prompted the essay? I mean, I think it's implied or openly stated in that statement there, but maybe expand a little bit just on what prompted the essay and your thoughts on the impression that it's made in fan studies.
Well, first I should say what prompted the essay was Kristen Warner inviting me to a panel. So that's how that happened. And I wrote that essay probably faster than anything I've ever written it. And I'm sort of, quite frankly, really have been shocked by how much it's been embraced and how many people value it. So I'm just grateful for that. So to all of you who find it useful, and that's really the most you can hope for as a scholar is that people find your work useful. But I think that, you know, there are a couple of different prongs or ways I would get at that question. The first is that all of my work, and I should say that I am disciplinarily unrecognizable to many people, because I'm so interdisciplinary. I mean, I started off as an undergrad with a quadruple major. My PhD is in English, but most people would not recognize that. And I had certificates in gender studies and African-American studies. And so people don't really know what links my work. And the what tends to link my work is the relationship between identity and political discourse and representation, broadly speaking. And so I'm always interested in the ways disciplines don't speak to each other when they're also might be thinking about the same question. So as someone who had been teaching, like reading and teaching about fan studies since I was a grad student, even if I wasn't writing it, and I probably taught Jenkins 20 years ago, as well as Jan and other people. I think that it's really intriguing as someone who also is very much an African-Americanist and works in Black cultural studies, that you had this whole strand of scholarship that I thought was doing some very similar things to ACA-fandom, but then they weren't thought about in relationship to each other. And these Black cultural studies scholars would not claim ACA-fandom, right? And then the fan studies people don't cite these Black cultural studies scholars to do some of this work. But also recognizing once I started really thinking about it and reviewing scholarship in these fields is that if you put Black people at the center, or you put this realm of scholarship at the center, it also challenges some of the major claims of fan studies. So that's something that I sort of worked through as I was, you know, reviewing the literature and thinking through, like, and trying to answer the question, why aren't these groups of scholars speaking to each other, really, in any substantive way?
It puts everything into relief in ways that I think people had not considered within, you know, well within fan studies. I did want to ask if 5 years on, is there anything about it that you've either had second thoughts about or you might want to expand on? Just sort of, you know, how do you feel about it 5 years on?
Well, one thing I should say is I try not to revisit my work unless I have to, but I have been thinking about it because I am going to do a book about race and fan studies and injury. So this will be sort of foundational to it. And so I think it's like further expanding both that question. I wish there was sort of more archival work in there in terms of like some of the claims I was making, but it's really about expansion that I'm thinking about. So I try to think about what the book version of this looks like.
Mm-hmm. You said injury?
Yeah, more and more. I thought it was just about race and fandom, but more and more in relationship to some of the other pieces I've written since then, which would not really be considered fan studies essays, I think, to most people, but are to me. So one, for example, I wrote an essay about Bill Cosby and Kobe Bryant and Michael Jackson and some other people for a special issue of Differences about African-American celebrities who've been accused of sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And what kind of injury it was for people who are fans of them and the things they produced to consider the possibility they're guilty, and then what it says, they feel like it says about them, or why, like this kind of refusal often, despite all the sort of evidence that might be before people, to imagine that they're guilty, or what it would mean for them if they're guilty. And I, you know, there's something about the response, and this is where I end up sort of going back to psychoanalysis, that it does seem to me that part of what happens is that if we deeply love someone, and it's, and particularly, and love attacks, and it's so foundational to our sense of self, as we develop as people, and it's something we use as reference points. And also for Black people, specifically, Black celebrity serves a different function in the sense that, you know, it's this sort of model success in this sort of space of scarcity. And so I ended up thinking about like their wives as alibis, and how they sort of construct these narratives about how you can still love despite failure, or also just the refusal to believe that such injury is possible. But I'm trying to think about like, you know, how we can hold on to what we love, even in the relationship to disappointment or failure or betrayal, mm-hmm. Which I think is something that happens a lot in relationship to our love objects, right? And there are people, J.K. Rowling, or various other people who may fail us. And then you're trying to figure out, like, can I still love this thing? And I actually want to say, like, you can still love things. And it's hard, I mean, sometimes. And then there's also the economic issue. Like, what does it mean to give someone money or something money? And then also just to think about failure of scale. Like, the difference between a serial rapist and, you know, someone who, and then, you know, something else, like a, you know, misstep in sort of racial representation. I just started reading Naomi Novik's new book, a book about sort of magical school. And there's been some controversy on Twitter in terms of people saying, talking about the racism, and there's a dreadlock thing. And then if I can, I mean, the number of things I've consumed over time that has, like, I will not use any profanity here, but just the way dreadlocks are treated. And I think this is also just in general about being a Black person who's a fan. To be a Black person, or to be a person of color often, and to sort of love popular culture, is to constantly face disappointment. It's to constantly be injured by representations, right? And so obviously we need to ask, demand, want things that are better. And the thing is, like, even the injuries are also often from people maybe who may look like us, that, you know, shared identity does not necessarily mean that things are going to be perfect, you know, in terms of, particularly if you have an intersectional perspective in which you recognize there are other kinds of injuries. It's not just about race. Like, the number of Black comedians who have homophobic screeds or sexist screeds is so extensive, you know? So there's a part of me that's like, oh, Dave Chappelle. But there are other things I still want to hold on to with Dave Chappelle, right? So there's someone in my most recent book, again, thinking about fan studies, I have this chapter called Rape, Race, and Race in the Gutter, where I'm talking about someone who was actually a fan artist, Richard Grass Green. And he was a fantastic artist, someone many people have not heard of. He wrote some and drew some really, really troubling comics, but he also did some work that was extraordinary. And I want to be able to think about how we keep some things and we have to let go of some other things. And for me, it's never about just sort of like getting rid of or throwing away the archive. What do we do with our troubled archives? And they're always going to be troubled because we live in a racist, sexist, classist, discriminatory world. And so our creators will reflect that in all their diversity.
that leads me in so many different directions, but I did want to mention with what you said about fandom for Black fans being sort of an ongoing exercise in disappointment. You have a phrase that you use in African-American ACCA fandom where you describe it as anxious waiting. And that is something that has stuck with me for years. I've quoted it in my own work because it really is the sense of always waiting for the other shoe to drop in a way. And of course, I'm saying this as a white woman sort of looking at Black fandom from the outside, but it's almost palpable, that sense that eventually the disappointment is going to come one way or another. And that has just always stuck with me. So I wanted you to know that. And I'm curious, with this sort of difficulty in confronting and working through the problems of, in particular, a Black popular cultural figure who has been deeply disappointing, I'm curious to what extent that dovetails with what Alfred Martin has talked about as kind of a felt responsibility to show up, whether you want to be there or not. There's sort of, you know, and I'm thinking, I think he talks about it specifically in terms of Black Panther, but, you know, that sense that I have to be there because it's important to be visible for this. And yet, so I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Well, I talk about that in African-American ACCA fandom and Other Strangers, mm-hmm. that one of the things I think that people miss in the framing of choosing otherness as sort of central to fandom is how often Black people are called to be fans. That, you know, it's considered a responsibility to support Black artists often, or Black films. And so now with social media, et cetera, we see like a lot of intense mobilization around that, around certain things. And I think it's interesting to think about like what you don't get around. Like, so you get it around Black Panther, but there are all kinds of like small Black films that I wish you would get it around, right? So, but I think that there's this long history of Black people being called to show up to watch things or to buy things, like the consumerism as, you know, an activist practice. And I think that you have to sort of think about that in expanding your parameters of sort of what fandom may be for different groups of people.
I also wanted to touch on that notion that you were talking about a few minutes ago of centering identity. You talk about it in the essay as identity hermeneutics, bringing, you know, sort of a focus on a specific identity through which to discuss these things. And as I communicated with you before we did this, when I first read it, it seemed to me like it was sort of siloing discussions. You know, over here we talk about Black fans and over here we talk about Chinese fans. And I actually sort of wrote about it as such until relatively recently. And to my own understanding, it seems that it is in fact a productive strategy in a context where we are also naming whiteness. And I'm curious first if that's even remotely close to what you were thinking when you talked about it.
I mean, I think it was Patricia Williams who I heard her say once that part of what you do when you write is, and part of your generosity as a writer, is to allow people to do with your framing and your work what they will, and they often will do more interesting things with it even that you might have done. So I will take what you're doing, but I would say that the concept has evolved more, and it's actually though quite central to my more recent book, which is very much about form. And I'm trying to work through and also contest certain kinds of tendencies in comic studies, and ask what happens to our analysis of comics as a medium when we put identity at the center of our reading practice, because hermeneutic is a reading practice, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens if we're thinking about race and we're thinking about Blackness and reading in how the gutter works or how the caricature works or how the sort of narrative structure is working? And then I, you know, did a version of this in an essay I wrote about American-born Chinese, like mm-hmm. that you think about Asian-American identity sort of at the center of what he's doing with that text. Like, you'll read the comic itself differently. And so if we think about putting race at the center, as opposed to something we're just adding on conceptually, then it actually pushes against how we understand the sort of more what could be seen as universal or foundational conceptual framework of the field that we're working in. So that would be my question as we think about sort of fan studies, when we place certain kinds of identities at the center. And so this is just my formulation of something that I think other people have done. I mean, I think there's a long history in how queer studies and people who think about queerness and fan studies have thought about what happens if you place queerness at the center. So when I teach, say, gentlemen prefer blondes, and I say, look, did they create this to be like, say, like, this is a queer text? No, but like, let's try to read this with a queer gaze, right? Like, what does it look like? And it's very easy for them, right? It's a film that lends itself so incredibly easy to queer readings. So their versions, their other articulations of what I'm doing. And I think the hermeneutic for me is more to call attention to the form piece, but also to the foundational question issue. Because part of what I do want to think about is like what's limited in terms of what we think about fan identity and what fandom is, and just or what's limited in terms of how I think how comics work or various other things work in their very foundations if we don't imagine different kinds of identities at the center. Because so often what's at the center is this kind of idealized white subject that you understand, Western subject that you understand at the center of it.
Right. Actually, what you were talking about in terms of looking at Gentlemen Prefer Blondes through a queer gaze actually put me in mind of, oddly, a film from a while back. Desmond Nakano, I believe, directed it called White Man's Burden. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or seen it. It's basically, it's supposed to be a social role reversed story about white people who are put in a black subjectivity. Harry Belafonte is a rich black man at the top of the social, and it actually does not work well at all. And yet it's a very interesting exercise in that kind of shifting the gaze. And so, I don't know, it's hard to find. I'm not sure I would recommend it, but it does put me in that mind simply for the experience, for the exercise or challenge of looking differently at something and saying, what if you look at it from this perspective?
Yeah, I know of the film, and it is because things that people have said about it that makes me feel like I'll be irritated. And so I have
probably
not. But I mean, and that's a sort of common convention, like let's do the flip, which I think in general often doesn't work well. I've been really interested, and this speaks to a perspective issue, the Knots and Crosses debate that's going on right now, the show's running on, was the Peabody Network. It was, you know, popular young adult series. And then the difference between, say, how there were a lot of fans of it in the UK, and then how, like, I think US audience who might not have experienced it are talking about what it is. And so, which also speaks to how I think I've often seen some differences between Black diasporic reading practices, like in terms of US and places in Europe, and so how people come at these issues or these texts. So I'm going to watch it and read the books at some point.
I wanted to move on a little bit in our discussion of fan studies and ask you, and this is a bit of an involved question, but I'm curious about your take on where we are in fan studies at the present moment. On the one hand, we've had quite a bit of new and emerging work on race and fandom and fan studies from scholars such as Rukmini Pandey, Alfred L. Martin, Crystal Anderson, Kristen Warner, Poe Johnson, Benjamin Wu, Elizabeth Hornsby, Miranda Larsen, and many others. And that is work that is forthcoming. Rukmini Pandey's edited collection is currently in pre-order with a discount from University of Iowa. On the other hand, informal conversation about fan studies amongst non-white scholars, many will steer clear of identifying themselves as fan scholars or as doing fan studies work, in large part because the field itself is perceived as being singularly unwelcoming to non-white scholars and work that doesn't fit this sort of normative white orientation. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely the case that that is one of the reasons. I also think there's some stigma still to fan studies as a category. And there's also a version of this with working in comics. And that's another interesting space where there's clearly, comic studies is clearly a place where there is fan studies, and fan studies is a place where there's comic studies. But there's some weird ways in which they don't interact. And so, but also just saying, I've literally said I work on comics and cartoon art, and someone says, oh no, you mean graphic novels. And I'm like, actually, no. Don't break me on my own field.
Well.
And, you know, which is a term that was really, you know, created to sort of bestow some respectability on the field. And so people will do it, and I am impatient with it. But I think, you know, to the early part of your question, there's also something else going on, I think. And this is part of what I probably feel less of as someone who's in so many different fields. Again, my disciplinary unrecognizability, which can also make me be very lonely and isolated in a lot of contexts, but I'm also just a visitor often. Mm-hmm. And so I feel, you know, those kinds, because I don't inhabit some spaces so fully, I can feel isolated and excluded as a visitor often, but I also then don't feel the injuries of what's happening if you're clearly always there at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. So there's something about fan studies that I think is a hyper visible example of something that I think goes on, broadly speaking, in the humanities and social sciences, which is this articulation of being a progressive space in ways that don't acknowledge perhaps how endemic whiteness might be and a kind of conservatism might be in the field. So that if you're in, you know, all kinds of spaces and doing humanist work, like everyone's like, oh, we're all progressive. It's like people claim they're all interdisciplinary. And I'm like, really? There's a kind of erasure rejection of the idea that there is something inherent to just how a discipline formed that creates exclusion. And I think fan studies is really interesting on that front because it is a place that really, and a field that really has articulated itself as being about underdogs and subjection, et cetera. But so much of the media that we consume or as fandoms, and fandom of a lot of what's out there, given the whole nature of mass media production that's basically for majority populations, means that what's idealized is whiteness and certain kinds of normative constructions of gender and sexuality. So that means that then when you attack absences and erasures there, and then going back to my claim about that sort of other essay I wrote, where people feel so attached in their love, right? Then you are just, there's a knee-jerk reaction to saying, no, no, you don't really get what you're doing. Oh, why don't you write your own thing? That's always my favorite. Why don't you write your own thing? As opposed to criticizing this, right? And I see someone just referenced, I don't have time to like totally read it, but referenced romance novels in the chat, and probably a number of people followed the massive cluster something that went on in romance over the holidays a number of months ago, right?
Yeah.
And I think that like trying to sort of work through, you know, what it means to be in fields that when you're an underrepresented population inherently has to sort of work through exclusions that are foundational is a problem that's not just in fan studies, but it spreads throughout, I think, all of the academy. Mm-hmm. And then I think that the ways in which fan studies and fans understand themselves as inherently progressive makes this worse. And also the ways in which the field is like not respected makes it worse. And so it becomes a sort of trifecta that produces, you know, various feelings about whether or not I feel like I can be here or not be there. To which I would just say, you know, and I've been following some things recently online. I mean, I do think that, I think social media, honestly, it just makes everything worse. when I think back to sort of being, I remember just one of the few times, like I might, you know, I would have exchanges online. I remember talking about the racial representation of the first Slayer on Buffy on a message board. And then just people just, you know, just being both condescending, mm-hmm. you know, really condescending at the idea that there was anything racially problematic or racist about those representations. And I think now just, and obviously there's scholarship about this sort of in other fields, there are things that effectively go on social media in terms of how it's structured that makes it a place less of support and intimacy and more of a place of combat and mm-hmm. evaluation, and again, of injury. And so I think that there's just a lot of hard thinking to do about how you bring people into a field and what will make people want to be part of it. But as someone who just moves between so many different fields, which has its cost, again, I'm not really of a lot of things. I think that it's totally possible to still have community and spaces. Like I mean, no one's going to push me out of any field I want to say I'm in, even if you just ignore mm-hmm. me. Like I can manage to write in various things and some people read it and I can have some conversations with people and that's all I need. I don't need these other people.
Mm-hmm. I know you've mentioned that you teach fan studies and that you have for quite a long time. And since some of this, especially this kind of fan studies, is coming from an underdog position in its default female transformative iteration, we tend to talk about, you know, women's pleasure first, that kind of thing. It seems in a certain way like we're kind of back to the question of genealogies and sort of how we talk about and teach about fan studies. And I'm wondering if in your classes, that's something that you sort of grapple with or, you know, try to change up a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always interested in multiple genealogies. So the gender piece, I think, is always an interesting one because I do think that it's really important, even though we have all of the scholarship, like recognizing how important women have been in relationship to fan studies, construction of fan fiction, and sort of these spaces. I think that there's... And I still show, even though, you know, the highly problematic but troubling but interesting SNL skit about Star Trek fans and about those, you know, that sort of stereotype of fans. I think that if you miss or ignore how foundational male fandom has been, and part of this also comes from being someone who works in comic studies. Mm-hmm. Like if you ignore boys and men and comic studies and fandom, you're just missing like in a really important genealogy, right? Mm-hmm. And again, when I think about sort of race and fan studies, there are these other genealogies. So I think that what's important in constructions of the fan is that you have to think about these sort of varied histories and their regional locations, historical moments, that which genre, by how genre makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Because again, I think, you know, coming in from if I insert sports in and I insert comics in and I insert mm-hmm. video games in, then you have this genealogy that's also really long running, but very different, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that people always really need to think about sort of what kind of general claims and perhaps problematic claims they're thinking about when they say this is the fan, because I think there's all kinds of evidence when you actually really think about the various archives that are available to us that problematize that.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that all of us in a lot of ways in thinking about our work or trying to figure out, like, which we probably encounter many times, you know, why does this matter? And how do we think about what our work does in this moment when, you know, people are literally dying, right?
Yeah.
And not just the pandemic, but, you know, the two, I mean, there's been George Floyd and the reemergence of Black Lives Matter. There's been what's been happening sort of politically. I mean, you know, I'm also a critical race theorist and the administration is at war against my field.
God, yes.
and, you know, I mean, I think for some people, I mean, this is job threatening, you know?
Yeah.
One thing so many of us are having in common is that, like, people are desperately seeking for things, not just as distraction, but like the things that people love or become attached to are really interesting in this mm-hmm. moment. and how it becomes a mechanism or language for how people talk about their lives or will tell stories about their lives, like, because this is, it's part of our shared experiences. So, I mean, I always say, as someone who works in the popular, I don't know what it means to say, like, well, isn't it just a TV show or isn't just this? When, in fact, we know that people will spend probably more time in their lives consuming things than they will do most other things other than sleeping over the course of their lives. Yeah. And at least in the West. And I think, obviously, there's strong arguments, and we should make strong arguments for the difference between people who are fans and then people who, you know, are just consumers or followers, perhaps. But I do think there's something to be said about intensity of affect and attachment and sort of making meaning in relationship to culture that we learn from fandom, like a fan subjectivity that's become a way of being for many people. And what that might help us understand about living and surviving in sort of moments where we're sort of looking for ways to connect with each other and you know, how are people sort of theorizing their lives, which I thought a lot about with The Good Place, for example, which was this like stunningly unusual sitcom about moral philosophy. And I still continue to think that popular culture is a place of great creativity that provides a mechanism for us to speak to each other. And that's why I think it's interesting to scholars.
Yeah. So we're sort of heading close to the end of our discussion. And since you move between disciplines, I wanted to kind of open up a question that I usually end the podcast with. Usually I ask people if there's anything that you could tell people who are unfamiliar with fan studies about it, what would that be? And I do want to get to that. But before I get to that, I'd like to ask you, is there anything that you would like people in fan studies to know in sort of a nugget of information or otherwise?
I would say that, you know, what's interesting to me is like, what are the missing archives or what are the things we can't access about fan histories? Mm-hmm. So for me, when I think about someone like Grass Green, and know he was working for a lot of, like writing and doing work for a lot of fanzines, and, you know, this question of archives and where they are and how we find things and how we preserve them and who should we look for to sort of understand these histories? So for example, he's someone who I would sort of point to is like, do you know who he is? You know, who can we find and what's important to know? I mean, when I think about this, I was listening to or looking at, you know, one of the presentations today. And I was thinking, you know, when we think about AOC or like these sort of like these databases of stories, like just huge numbers of stories, like this kind of archive, right? And I wonder in the future, it's like how what will people make of, or how will people continue to do work with this archive with its massive scale, right? I think, you know, I was really thinking like methodologically, what will this archive mean for people? You know, what's happened or where are, like, you know, I think about the various, you know, various sites I used to go to, fan fiction, some of which are now, you know, have been moved and Lexa Rock is there, but, you know, but just maybe lost or something. And I guess, you know, the thing to sort of not, so it's not an issue of like what people should know, but how do we think about our archives as a field, which also includes like television shows and that are lost. And we sort of want to do things like, you know, people's relationship to them. How do we find those, you know, for, you know, fan letters we may not be able to find, exchanges we can't find, fan videos that have been pulled off YouTube we don't have anymore. Like, I mean, what, you know, what do we do, or what do we think about like the ephemerality of that as a field where we preserve an archive if the field will be sustained? And I think that really matters.
Yeah. So what, if you could say anything about fan studies to someone who had no idea about it, what would you say?
Well, I mean, that happens all the time. Yeah. I basically say like, yeah, it's a field that's a, you know, a few decades old, and that the reason that it is important is speaks to a lot of the things I've been saying throughout this conversation, which is that, you know, fandom is actually more central to more people's lives than I think people will recognize. And why would you want to ignore something that people spend so much time doing? Again, this pushes against, in some ways, I think, an insistence on like fandom and claiming fandom and otherness and minority status is a specificity, right? But I do sort of want to push against that because I just think we have now just so much evidence. Because of, I mean, as much as I push against social media, it's social media that it shows us this, that the spirit of fandom and that commitment and how many people participate is really widespread in a lot of ways. And so it's a way of thinking and being in the world. I mean, I think there's obviously a particular space for people who are claiming fandom in a way in terms of how they want to organize like friendships and communities and do things. But I think that once, you know, I think about Constance Penley and talking about NASA Trek and how people are like, well, this is just such a minor, like who does this, such small people, no one will even hear of this, and slash fiction, and that's just, you know, such a minor thing. And then the internet, and just like over the last few decades, I mean, the proof of the sort of the kind of desires and investments people had, even if they're not transforming a work and transforming sort of how we might read it or think in the ways that people who are committed to fandom in that way do. I do think there's this other thing we need to think about in relationship to fandom, these other kinds of aspects of fan identity and articulation that have to be considered.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a really great conversation.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode of It's a Thing. I hope to be back with a second season in the near future, but until then, thank you for listening and happy fan studies.